wish, and whenever a wish is voiced, even silently, even without words, it becomes a supplication. Perhaps we don't know to whom we're speaking. Perhaps we ask before we truly know who's listening, or before we even believe that listener exists. But I judge it a very fine beginning to make a practice of remembering those people we have loved. When we remember others fondly, we wish them health and happiness and all good things. These are the prayers of a Christian man. The Christian man looks outward, T. Rao. He loves others first, himself second. This is why the Christian man has many brothers, alike and unalike. For none of us is so dissimilar, would you not agree, when perceived from a collected point of view?
We do perceive from the advantage of this collective point of view that Te Rau Taufari and Carol Devlin are indeed very similar in a great many ways. The most pertinent of these, however, are to go both unobserved and unremarked. Neither man possesses curiosity enough to disturb the other's prideful equanimity, nor truly to draw him out. They are to stand forever proximal, one the act of his own self-expression, the other the proof of it.
A prayer needn't always be a supplication, of course, Devlin added. Some prayers are expression of gladness, some are expressions of thanks. But there is hope in all good feeling, Te Rau, even in feelings that remember the past. The prayerful man, the good man, is always hopeful. He's always an optimist. A man is made hopeful by his prayers.
Taufari, who had received this sermon doubtfully, only nodded. These are wise words, he added, feeling pity for his interlocutor. In general, Taufari's conception of prayer was restricted to the most ritualized and oratorical sort. The ordered obeisance of the Fai Corero produced in him, as did all rituals of speech and ceremony, a feeling of centrality and calm, the likes of which he could not manufacture alone, and nor did he wish to. The sensation was quite distinct from the love he felt for his family, which he experienced as a private leaping in his breast, and distinct, too, from the pride he felt in himself, which he felt as a pressurized excitement, an elated certainty that no man would ever match him, and no man would ever dare to try. It ran deeper than the natural goodness that he felt, watching his mother shuck muscles and pile the slippery meat into a wide-mouthed flax basket on the shore, and knowing as he watched her that his love was good and wholly pure. It ran deeper than the virtuous exhaustion he felt after a day stacking the Rua Kumara, or hauling timber, or plaiting harakeke until the ends of his fingers were pricked and raw. Te Rau Taufari was a man for whom the act of love was the true religion, and the altar of this religion was one in place of which no idols could be made.
"Shall we go to the grave together?" Devlin said.
The wooden headstone that marked Crosby Wells' grave had surrendered already to the coastal climate. 2 weeks following the hermit's death, the wooden plaque was already swollen, the face already spotted with a rime of black mould. The indentation of the cooper's engraving had softened, and the thin accent of paint had faded from white to a murky yellow-grey, giving the impression not altogether dispelled by the stated year of his death that the man had been deceased for a very long time. The plot was yet unseeded by lichen or grass, and despite the rain, had a barren look, not of earth recently turned, but of earth that had settled and would not be turned again. The favoured epitaphs here were chiefly beatitudes from Matthew, or oft-quoted verses from the Psalms. Injunctions to sleep and be at peace did not reassure, however, as they might have done in some hedged and cobbled parish 10,000 miles away. It was in the company of the lost and the drowned that Crosby Wells lay at his eternal rest, for there were yet only a handful of headstones in the plot at Seaview, and most of them were memorials erected in honour of vessels that had been wrecked or lost at sea. The Glasgow, the city of Dunedin, the New Zealand, as though entire cities, entire nations, had been bound for the coast only to run aground or sink or disappear. On the hermit's right was a memorial to the brigantine Oak, the first ship to founder at the mouth of the Hokitika River, a fact engraved with forbidding premonition upon the greenish stone. On Wells' left was a wooden headstone barely larger than a plaque, which bore no name at all, only a verse, unattributed, "My times are in your hand." None too far from the cemetery was the site of George Shepherd's future jailhouse, the foundations of which had been paced and measured out already, the dimensions marked in white lead paint upon the soil. It was the first time that Taufari had ventured to sea view since Wells' interment, a ceremony that had taken place before a small and perfunctory audience, and despite very heavy rain. In these aspects, and in the general speed with which the conventional blessings were dispatched, Wells' funeral had seemed to embody every kind of inconvenience and every kind of dreariness. Needless to say, Te Rau Taufari had not been invited to contribute to the proceedings. In fact, George Shepherd had specifically enjoined him, with an ominous wag of his large knuckled finger, to keep silent during all but the chaplain's Amen, a chorus to which Taufari did not, in the event, add his voice, for Devlin's benediction was quite swallowed in the downpour. He was permitted to assist in lowering Wells' coffin down into the mud of the hole, however, and in depositing 30, 40, 50 shovelfuls of wet earth after it. He should have liked to do this alone, for the party made short work of filling the hole, and it seemed to Taufari that everything was over far too soon. The men, pulling their collars up about their ears, buttoned their coats, took up their earth-spattered tools, and trooped single file back down the muddy switchback to the warmth and light of Hokitika proper, where they shucked their greatcoats and wiped their faces dry and changed their sodden boots for indoor shoes. Taufari came silently upon the grave of his friend, Devlin following, his hands folded, his expression peaceful. Taufari halted some 5 or 6 feet from the wooden headstone, and looked upon the plot as though upon a deathbed from a chamber doorway, as though fearing to step bodily into the room. Taufari had never seen Crosby Wells beyond the Arahura Valley. He had certainly never seen him here, upon this forsaken terrace ravaged by the sky. Had the man not said countless times that it was in the solitary Arahura that he wished to end his days? It was senseless that he should have been laid to rest here, among men who were not his brethren, upon soil he had not worked and did not love, while his dear old cottage stood empty and abandoned some dozen miles away. It was that soil that ought to have claimed him. It was that earth that ought to have turned his death to fertile life. It was in the Arahura, Taufari thought, that he ought to have been buried.